Dr. Ben Edwards, you're the Cure program right here on AM 580. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com, for past archived programs. We have them all available there, veritasmedical.com. Let me say good morning once again to Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, Melody Wilkes, health coach, special guest via telephone this morning as well. Good morning, everybody. Hope you're all having a wonderful Monday. I know I am. I'm ready to learn something new, as I do each and every week right here on the show. And, of course, along the way, if you have any questions, feel free to call or text. You can certainly do that at 806-745-5800. That's 806-745-5800 along the way.
All right. Thank you, Wade. Good to be here again this morning. And we are really happy to have a special guest. Sorry, let me mute my phone.
Hello.
Hello.
We have got, we're going to be a little more political than usual today.
So no.
Right up your
Say
alley,
it
Wade.
So.
We've got Judith McGeary, who is the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. And I've had a number of people over the past few months tell me I really needed to get Judith on the show because we talk about local farming practices all the time. We encourage local farmers to kind of look at more a regenerative type of programs. We encourage local farmers to produce food that we can consume, vine-ripened. Quality nutrient-dense food locally. We've talked to some farmers market folks and just local ag producers too. So this is kind of the next step is bringing in Judith to talk about a lot of the kind of the policies and legislative actions. And of course, we're in the legislative session right now with the state of Texas, so perfect timing there. But before we bring Judith on, I just want to remind, especially if you're a newer listener, why do we talk about farming so much? Why do we talk about organic farming and regenerative ag? And we had Jeffrey Smith on a few weeks ago talking about the genetic roulette and GMOs and Roundup. We've had a number of Roundup experts, glyphosate experts. Why do we talk about that so much? This is a doctor show. This is a health show. But obviously, if you've listened at all, you understand that what we preach at Veritas and what the reason we do this show to educate the masses is we really believe the body knows exactly how to do what it's supposed to do, which means keep your blood pressure normal and keep your blood sugar normal and normal sleep patterns and normal mood and et cetera, et cetera. The body knows how to function normally if you give it what it needs and avoid what it doesn't need. Unfortunately, somebody or group of somebodies many years ago made a decision for all of you that when it comes to your health, you are not going to address the root cause, which is diet and lifestyle, epigenetics. The Americans just aren't going to do that. We are not going to change our diet, change our stress habits, and exercise and hydrate well, and the basics. We're not going to do those basics, so therefore, all you're left with when it comes to physical symptoms and mental symptoms is treating the symptom. Management of disease is what is taught in medical school. So we learn how to manage type 2 diabetes instead of reverse it. We learn how to manage hypertension and manage your insomnia and manage your autoimmune disease and manage everything. And management comes with a pill. A quick, easy pop a pill, swallow a pill, and then you go on about your business. And the symptoms of inflammation can be reduced. And I use the word inflammation because we know we've talked ad nauseum about how inflammation is a common denominator of every disease, from migraines to fibromyalgia to lupus to headaches to cancer to heart attack to stroke to Alzheimer's to allergies and eczema. Inflammation. So pills can knock out inflammation to a degree. And so you can feel better. Your rash can calm down. Your aches and pains can calm down. Your coronary disease, your chest pain can calm down. Your memory won't really get better. The management drugs for Alzheimer's don't work that well. But pretty much we can manage. Your blood sugar can come down. Your blood pressure can come down. But it's all at some expense, some unintended consequence not just purely a side effect, but the unintended consequence of you're not dealing with the root cause of diabetes. You're not dealing with the root cause of hypertension. So if the root cause isn't addressed, it's still going to come get you, even if you're managing it really, really, really well with pharmaceutical. So this third option, which is let the body fix itself, some people call it a cure or put it into remission or whatever word you want to use, it's politically correct. It doesn't really matter to me. It's just steward your health by feeding it what it needs, hydrating it with clean hydration, moving around a little bit every day, and being at peace. The very basic four pillars, we call it. So let thy food be thy medicine and thy medicine be thy food. That's one of the four pillars is nutrition. And obviously everybody kind of wants to start there when they think about health and wellness and addressing root causes of disease. We all think about food, and we should. That's a very, very important pillar. We can't ignore any of the four pillars, but nutrition is kind of the one everyone starts with and goes to. So very, very important. And the food needs to be high quality, needs to be clean. It needs to be as close to the form that God originally made it as possible, meaning a cow needs to be eating grass, not grain in a feedlot. Same with pigs and chickens and every other animal. If you can get milk as close to the original coming out of the udder as possible, it's more beneficial. There's reasons we take people off of grain and dairy and sugar when they're very, very inflamed, because the standard American industrialized forms of those food-like substances, and I say food-like because they've been altered so much. When man puts his hand to food and alters it, whether that's genetically alter it or alter it after it comes out of, after they've harvested it with chemicals or homogenization, pasteurization, etc. Antibiotics, hormones. When we do stuff to food, it changes it, and in a way that can be detrimental to the body and drive inflammation. So local food, least processed as possible, and a wide variety of it. Eat like your great-great-grandparents and your ancestors did before there were a whole lot of regulations on the food. That's so important. But we've got to have access to this kind of food. So that's super important. We tell young farmers all the time, hey guys, think about doing something non-conventional. Let's do some regenerative stuff. But then these guys have to be able to sell their products. So we've got to be able to sell. And that's where Judith comes in. So that's a very long segue in, Judith. And I'm sorry to take so much time, but really like to lay that foundation. So Judith, I don't think I said, Judith is an attorney, an activist, and a sustainable farmer, her and her husband. She earned bachelor's of science from Stanford University and her law degree with high honors, mind you, from the University of Texas at Austin. And she clerked for federal appeals court and went on to private law practice. And she became a passionate advocate during this time for sustainable ag. She met her husband and established their own livestock farm. And after seeing how government regulations benefit industrial ag at the expense of family farms, she founded the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance to promote common sense policies for local diversified ag systems. So that's just part of the intro. Y'all can read more on Judith's website, farmandranchfreedom.org. So Judith, thank you so much for joining us on the show today, and I know you've got a lot to talk about, but welcome, and any comments or additions to that intro that I might have missed on your background, or any comments on my intro comments.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, and I couldn't agree more with what you were saying. You know, for me, I started, you know, when I took this idea of, like, we're doing all the right stuff. We're raising healthy food for people. I mean, all the things you were talking about of, you know, helping people heal. And for me, it was also healing the land. And you look around, and I had no interest in this being political. It was like, well, of course you just do this. We're going to feed people. Who could object to us feeding people good food?
Right.
And then you discover that somehow a lot of different people object to you feeding people good food. And that's why I ended up going down the political path is I realized that if we wanted these options for farmers and consumers to be able to connect around this healthy food, things were going to have to change in our government system.
Right. Well, let's step back a little bit real briefly, and how did you get into what opened your eyes to doing sustainable ag in the first place?
So I went to law school to do environmental law with my biology background. And I got into environmental law and was really disillusioned over the ability to make a difference and come out with real solutions, not just arguing. And so I wanted to go back and study and go into more hands-on work. And I met a professor over at University of Texas, Dr. Dick Richardson, who looked at me and said, well, if you care about the environment, you should care about where your food comes from. And this was 20 years ago. I mean, regenerative ag wasn't even a word. You know, organic was kind of there. Local wasn't really there. And I had no idea what he was talking about, really. But he got me reading some really amazing work by Alan Savory, Acres USA, the folks who were doing what we now call regenerative agriculture, really sophisticated but low-tech forms of agriculture that produce amazing results. And it was this paradigm shift for me. I fell in love with it and started studying it and deciding that this is what I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
Wow, that's awesome. And your husband?
My husband was in the Coast Guard at the time. He'd been in for quite a long time. He was nearing retirement. And, you know, he hadn't grown up on a farm. He'd grown up in a small town in Pennsylvania and had always been drawn to animals in particular and agriculture a little bit, but particularly animals. So when he got out of the Coast Guard, we decided to start a livestock farm.
Cool. And where was this at?
This was in Austin at the time. I bought some land right after law school, and we were just outside Austin. We've since sold that farm and bought a slightly larger one, still a small farm by terms of the agriculture industry, but a little bit more room to do what we do a bit further out in Central Texas.
Okay. So y'all were actually starting to produce, and as you were producing, is that what led you to start to see some of the obstacles and hurdles to overcome to take that food to market? Or is that something
you just
learned from others?
We started seeing, we served as a drop point for raw milk for another farmer because we were raw milk consumers, and it was crazy. It still is. You have to deal with getting raw milk from a farmer. It's like doing a cocaine deal. Like, I'll meet you in the parking lot and give you money for the white stuff.
Yeah.
There was that. There's another issue. I mean, it's interesting actually trying to think back almost, this is, again, 15 years ago, how some of the problems I'm trying to deal with, our organization trying to deal with in the legislature right now are still there. I mean, this doesn't go quick.
Right.
We were doing poultry, and there's an exemption for processing poultry for farmers doing their own poultry on farm. So we started processing, thinking what we were doing was legal, and then discovered, thankfully before the regulators did, that what we were doing was not legal. And that if we actually wanted the so-called exemption, we'd have to build a $40,000 facility.
Wow.
You start running into stuff like that, and you're like, this just doesn't even make sense.
Yep.
You know, that none of it makes sense from a health perspective, what the consumers are looking for, from what's just realistic. None of it made any sense whatsoever until you looked at it from the perspective of people who want an industrial, large-scale food system, which is what our food system's been built on. The government policies have been explicitly get big or get out. And when you start realizing that, you it's like, oh, well, yes, I guess this does make sense.
Right. It's all about perspective. Can you explain the raw milk thing a little bit? Some of our listeners, we do have two raw milk dairies in the Lubbock area, Peoria Pastures in Abernathy and Field of Dreams down by O'Donnell. Some folks are familiar with kind of how you have to go about getting raw milk, but can you explain what the current law is and maybe why that is and some of the challenges there?
Of course. So raw milk is simply milk that hasn't been cooked. I mean, it's that simple. It's milk that hasn't been pasteurized. It does have to be handled carefully. You want a good producer. And in Texas, these producers, such as the two you mentioned, become grade A licensed. So they go through this very extensive licensing regime. They have to meet the same or higher standards at every step of the way, literally from the live animal to the bottled milk, that the milk in the grocery stores has to meet. I've literally gone through the regulations line by line. They are exactly the same or even stricter for the raw milk producers. But at the end of all of that, when they've done all that work and they have this very clean product, they can't sell it except on the farm. So the consumer, the regulation says the sale must be on the farm. So the consumer is expected to drive out to the farm every single time they want raw milk. This is, we don't do this for any other legal product. I mean, there's no such thing. Raw oysters, go to the grocery store and get them. You don't have to drive to the coast and buy them from the fishermen. But there's huge opposition every time we try doing it. We've just been trying to get it to the farmers markets and to legalize delivery, just to allow the farmers to bring the milk to the customers. And now we are on session 5, 10 years of fighting for something that basic.
What about the whole cow share thing? If you own part of the cow, does that change anything?
So cow shares in Texas are an untested area. So there's no statute on it, and there's no court cases that deal with it. But the concept is sound legally. The basic concept is there's no law against my drinking milk from my own cow. Everyone agrees to that. I can buy a cow, milk her, and drink my milk, and there's no problem. Why can't I share that cow with somebody else? And maybe two or three or four families buy a cow. We could board that cow with a farmer so that we don't have to take care of her today, day to day. And we could have an agreement with the farmer and pay the farmer to take care of our cow, milk the milker every day, because cows have to get milked every day, and provide us with the milk. And he's not selling the milk. He's simply taking care of the animal. The milk is already ours because we paid for the cows. So that's the concept of a cow share. Again, it's basic legal principles. I mean, every single one of those steps is legal under normal contract law in Texas, as well as the health and safety code. The health departments contend that it's illegal to do that. And they've stared down several cow shares, and no one's gone to court over it yet, which means no one really knows what a Texas judge would decide if faced with the case.
So the main opposition would be health, or at least on the surface, is that the position that the raw milk is potentially going to cause some kind of outbreak of some awful disease?
That's the argument. And there are some people who genuinely believe that. So let's be clear. There are people who use that argument who believe it. Sadly, they aren't looking at the data, or they don't believe the data, apparently. The data is, you know, some people have gotten sick from raw milk, just like people have gotten sick from any food out there. I mean, name a food and you can find a foodborne illness outbreak from it. But the numbers aren't high. They aren't frequent. They aren't large. They're sporadic, small-scale outbreaks. In Texas, there's been fewer than two illnesses a year on average for the last 20 years. Out of an estimated 750,000 Texans who drink raw milk would be the best estimate based on CDC consumption data. So is this high risk? No. You know, is there some risk? Yeah. There's also risk from eating all kinds of foods. You know, chicken soup carries a risk. There are people who've gotten sick from strawberries in our state. You know, any food carries risk. The other opposition comes from the dairy industry. And they, of course, their stated reason is, well, it's dangerous and we don't want dangerous products out there, you know, and people might get confused and stop buying milk in the grocery stores. That is their argument. Their claim is if there's a raw milk outbreak, people stop buying milk even in the grocery stores, which is nonsense. It's never happened, including in states where raw milk is sold in grocery stores side by side with regular pasteurized milk. Raw milk outbreaks don't affect their sales. The real reason is they don't like competition. Because as in much of agriculture right now in the food industry, there's a handful of large entities that control the market. We do not have a free market by any stretch of the imagination. It is tightly controlled. In Texas, there's 4 co-ops. That's it. And in many parts of the state, there's only 1 co-op that functions. So if you're a farmer, a dairy farmer, a conventional dairy farmer, there's 1 buyer for your milk. That's it.
Wow.
And they don't really want those farmers to have another option. They don't want those farmers to have the option to go direct to consumer. They don't want the farmers to have alternatives to simply selling their milk to these co-ops. And so they oppose anything like the raw milk bill that would give these farmers other options.
Well, that's unfortunate. And I don't want to waste, it wouldn't be a waste of time, but we could spend a whole lot of time talking about the pros and cons of conventional dairy, just the dairy part, but we need to get to other things. But I just had a conversation before we went on air with the local regenerative ag guy, and he was talking about all the water consumption by the dairies and how the dairies around here, anyways, eastern New Mexico and West Texas, are consuming a high amount of water to the point of even more than some of the farmers, the cotton farmers. And he was wondering if a lot of these California dairymen and women have moved out here because of that water shortage in California. Now they're sucking all the water here. And that's one tiny piece, well, I guess big piece, but we could go into, you know, feeding the grains, the antibiotics, the hormones, the type of milk that's produced, and of course the pasteurization of that and what that produces from a health perspective. But that's probably a whole nother show. But I just want people to be aware there's a whole lot here besides just the idea of we need to have a free market and a choice and consumers and farmers be able to interact easier and more freely. That's for sure needed. But there's a whole lot about this whole dairy, conventional dairy operation that we could raise our eyebrows out and debate a whole lot about. But probably need to move on to other things unless you have any comments on that, Judith.
No, I mean, beyond raw milk, I mean, the conventional ag industry uses a huge amount of water. And any agriculture takes some water. You can't raise animals, you can't raise grain, you can't raise any type of crop without water. But regenerative agriculture and pasture-based livestock production use a fraction of the water that's required for the conventional industry. And it's something we've got to start dealing with. I'll say we do work. We also work on water issues because without water, there's no point trying to fight for local farms if they don't have any water available. And the water policy in our state is incredibly short-sighted and is very focused on let's assume some technology is going to save us in the future and just keep using up our water as if we, you know, there's no end in sight, is really a pretty fundamental perspective in the legislature. And it's a bit terrifying. And in the meantime, all we can do, I mean, so one thing we do is we fight bad water bills and we fight that. And on the ground, we work on agricultural practices that conserve our water and improve our water quality, which is, I think, this is the crisis to come for Texas, and it's coming up faster than anybody really wants to believe.
Yeah. Well, a few weeks ago, we had a local farmer who's also a patient of mine, and he also presses and sells black cumin seed oil. But on his farm, he was talking about how he has used cover crops and basically no-till, and he's been doing that for a number of years. And he talked about a rain shower that they had that dumped, I forget how many inches of rainwater on his land. And right across the fence, his neighbor who practice regenerative, who tills his land, how there was major runoff. And I mean, like, there were ditches in his field, and the road actually had washed out in front of this neighbor's field. But the no-till farmer who we were interviewing walked across his field and could barely tell that it had rained because it soaked in like a sponge when you keep those roots in the soil. And we've talked to Gabe Brown and others about the how this works, but the absorption capabilities of the ground when you do no-till and other regenerative practices is amazing how you can hold on to that water. And even in a drought condition, the moisture content of that soil will be so much better. So I encourage listeners, if you haven't heard those interviews, go back and listen to those. We've interviewed a number of local farmers about that very thing. Judith, I know there's a lot of bills in the legislature right now. In fact, I got an email the other day from Weston A. Price Foundation urging me and others to call one of our local representatives, state reps, about an ag bill that I think it passed the House and was being held up in the Senate. That could be reversed. And it was, hey, call this guy's office to put the pressure on to at least bring this to a vote on being able to sell ungraded eggs. And so there's that. There's a number of others I think that you want to talk about, and we want to encourage the listeners to get informed. And if you feel led to call your congressman or senator to do that, but probably be a good time to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we can run through all these legislative things that are on the docket and get into all that. So if you'll stick with us, Judith, we'll take a quick break. And listeners, y'all stick with us. We'll be right back with Judith McGeary, and she's with the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, .org. Stick with us.
Welcome back into You're the Cure right here on AM 580. Dr. Ben Edwards, MD with Veritas Medical. Check out the website, Veritas Medical, for past archived programs. You'll find them right there at veritasmedical.com. Right back at it. So we have a special guest, Judith, here talking about all kinds of good stuff going on down. And I say good stuff, it could be classified as bad stuff, but we're working on the issue.
It's all perspective. We have got happy to have Judith McGeary here. She's with Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, executive director, founder of that organization. Farmandranchfreedom.org is the website. I think I said it wrong when we're going to break, but farmandranchfreedom.org is a website. You can check it out and get involved, get on the newsletter email list and donate if you feel led to, but just probably being involved is the most important thing, and let your voice be heard. So Judith, let's jump right into what's going on in Austin, specifically with the bills that you're looking at that can help promote, and I think your website said it best, it's really looking out for the local smaller producer, the farmers who are trying to sell directly to consumer, these bills that can promote that, as opposed to bills that only look out for the large industrialized farming and ranching practices. So let's jump into whichever bills you think are most important or that we could help you the most on.
Gladly. And I just want to echo what you said, which is the most important thing is getting involved. There actually is good news. We've got 7 bills that have a realistic chance of passing, each of which that makes a real difference for small farmers and the consumers who want to buy from them. And that's really unprecedented. I mean, we founded FARFA 13 years ago, and we've done a lot over the years, both in stopping bad stuff and passing good stuff, but we've never had a time where we've had this much potential for reform. And some of that is due to more and more people getting involved. That over the years, we've got more people who've been picking up the phone, talking to their legislators, and it really does make a difference, and we've seen that difference. So diving into the bills, I'll start with one of the funnest ones, which is the cottage foods bill. Before 2011, it was actually illegal for anyone to make food at home and sell it. I mean, all those people who do pies around Thanksgiving and sell them for a little extra cash or whatever, all completely illegal. And many people didn't even know that, or they did, and they just hoped not to get caught.
Tamale selling around here, I think, around Christmas time. I used to always buy tamales from
church fundraisers, school
fundraisers.
Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff. And some of the nonprofit stuff is exempted. If it's literally under a nonprofit, like if there's a recognized nonprofit doing it, there's some exemptions. But mean, there was a lot of stuff happening illegally and people not doing stuff because they knew it was illegal. Mm-hmm. So in 2011, we got the first what's called cottage foods law passed, which was allowing small-scale folks to make certain foods in their home kitchens and sell it directly to consumers. And it's been a great law. There have been over 1,000 new businesses founded in Texas under this law. But it's pretty restrictive. It only allows certain types of foods, only at certain locations. It excludes a bunch of the foods that particularly farmers want to be able to sell. And so we came back this year with a bill to significantly expand it and open up new opportunities. And one of the, from a health perspective, one of the most exciting opportunities that this bill would open up would be in fermented foods. So all of these very healthy, live, probiotic foods like kimchi and sauerkrauts and these things that really help heal the gut would be allowed now under this bill if it passes.
Awesome.
And it can make a huge difference. We've got one farmer, he went around the Capitol meeting with legislators with me, who was talking, you know, he actually does sell ferments already, but he has to pay $6,000 a year to rent a commercial kitchen to do the exact same thing he could be doing in his home kitchen. So that's the bill there, Senate Bill 572 and House Bill 644. And it expands what types of foods are allowed. It allows them to be sold anywhere in the state as long as it's this direct to consumer. It allows these ferments. It allows frozen fruits and vegetables. It's just a great, great bill. And it's got a good chance of passing if we can just move it forward. Each bill needs one more step moved forward in the House and the Senate to become law. So that's one of them. And we have all of these bill numbers listed on our website. So I'm going to mention the bill numbers, but folks, I'd encourage folks to call their legislator, and you can find all of this on our website if you go to farmandranchfreedom.org. And we have, you can sign up for email alerts, and we put out email alerts a couple of times a week during this busy time. And we also have what we call a bill tracking page. And you just look under the What's New section, and you'll see the bill tracking page, and it'll have all of the bill numbers and all the technical stuff like that.
Good.
So going to the bill that you mentioned, by the way, which is a lovely little bill we're still hoping to keep alive. For folks, you know, I think everyone's seen in the grocery store, you know, like grade A eggs and probably had no idea what that meant. I certainly didn't until I got into agriculture. It's simply a system of physical characteristics that were put into place to standardize egg sales. Really after World War II when we moved to this industrialized food system. So it looks like things like how clean is the shell? You use a high-powered light called a candle light to candle the eggs and see if there are blood spots in them. You know, things like that. It's not a food safety issue. It's not really a quality issue the way I believe quality. You know, I look at quality and I think, what did the chicken eat? You know, how many nutrients are in this egg from what the chicken ate? You know, it's a quality standpoint from, you know, you don't get cracked shells, you don't have, you know, lots of blood spots. You know, it's that kind of quality. But it's really meant for this industrial-sized food system. And right now, you can go to a farmer's market and you can buy ungraded eggs from the farmer. But if a restaurant tries to buy them, let's say you've got a restaurant that wants to source local, it's illegal, and they can get shut down for buying ungraded eggs. So we've got a bill, Senate Bill 1805, that would allow restaurants and actually small-scale retailers to buy from local farmers. Unfortunately, it flew through the Senate. It was on wings, and it got to the House. And as you mentioned, there was an alert that went out about 2 weeks ago because the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, Chairman Springer, hasn't been letting the bill come to a vote. And so we've been asking him and pushing. We are in discussions with him. Those phone calls got attention, and we are in discussions about whether there's a compromise bill that he would allow to move forward. But I'd encourage people to keep up those phone calls because nothing is settled. There is not an agreed-upon compromise yet. There's so many chefs who want to be able to source local. There are so many farmers that this could be a good opportunity for. And there's really no good reason not to.
Yeah, there's no health reason. And I did make that phone call, didn't actually get to speak to a live person, left a very detailed message, though. They haven't called me back yet. I'm sure they're waiting. But my specific comment was, hey, if you have any health concerns about ungrated eggs, I'd be happy as a physician to address any of those you may have and enlighten you if possible. And because like you said, it's not a health issue. It's a uniformity of how your eggs look kind of issue. Which, of course, we have our own chickens and eat our own eggs at my house, and they're all different shapes and sizes and hardness of shells, and some with blood spots. I ate one this morning with a blood spot. No big deal. But anyways, I encourage people to get on there and call, and we want local folks to be able to sell to other local folks.
Exactly. And thank you for making that call. And they probably won't call you back because they're swamped. I mean, these guys, I can get on their cases a lot, and there's good reason to. But at this moment, I also kind of feel sorry for them because they're working 16 to 18 hour days.
Yeah.
So they are logging all those calls, though. If folks want to, aren't sure, it's like, does my call make a difference? I can tell you, I've been in those offices. They log each and every call they get. And they look at how many calls they've gotten. And those calls make a much, let me go ahead and sort of go off the subject of the bills and just talk activism for a moment. They have such a greater impact than those auto emails. We always get asked, well, why don't you just do one of those sort of like punch a button and it sends a message? Because those they mostly ignore. Honestly, those forum emails that you just punched online, they're going to basically ignore those. Phone calls, they do not ignore. They pay attention, and they have such a greater impact. So thank you for making the call. And messages count, too. Phone call where you leave a message, same. You've gotten the point there.
Okay, good to know. Some inside baseball there. Bill?
So another one, which we're hoping it's actually going to get voted on by the House tomorrow, and we're cautiously optimistic that it'll pass, is Senate Bill 932, which would cap the permit fee that farmers are charged. Because right now we've got a lot of local governments that seem to believe that farmers are rich. I really have no clue where they've gotten this illusion. And so they charge really high permit fees, higher than what they charge conventional businesses. So like in several jurisdictions, we have farmers who sell at a farmer's market for, 3 hours once a week, who are paying 2 to 3 times the permit fee that a McDonald's pays for its business establishment that's open 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Wow.
It's crazy. So Senate Bill 932 caps those permit fees for farmers and those selling at farmers markets. It's already passed the Senate. It's on the House floor tomorrow. We think it looks really good for it to pass. So that could make a big difference. Again, depends on the jurisdiction. I actually don't remember the Lubbock, permit fees and whether they're one of the high ones. But statewide, that's something that could make a huge difference for farmers being able to sell and just being able to afford to sell at these markets. We've then got another bill that actually needs calls. So I'll focus on that one. And this one is sitting in the Senate. And the call would be to the senators, and it's House Bill 410, and it actually goes to the issue that I briefly mentioned at the beginning of the call, which is this idea of poultry processing exemptions. So right now, under federal law, there's provision that farmers can process up to, under federal law, 20,000 birds a year. And they're exempt from most of the federal regulations. There's some labeling and record keeping and some basic provisions, which are fine. But it's up to the states as to how they want to implement it. And in Texas, they've implemented it incredibly narrowly and with great difficulty. So as a comparison, in 45 other states, someone who's processing 1,000 birds or fewer basically doesn't have any state regulation put on them. Some states require them to register with the health department so that they know they're out there. Some states don't even do that much. If there's a complaint, the health department comes in and looks at what the problem is and figures out what to do. But it's totally a complaint-driven process. In contrast, in Texas, supposedly the home of, you know, entrepreneurship, if you want to process so much as a single chicken, you have to build a facility that's the same standards as if you were a full-scale commercial-grade federal facility. It costs about $40,000 to $50,000.
Let me guess, there's a few commercial facilities in Texas that would...
Oh, but big poultry is big business in our state. Yeah. big poultry has a lot of incentive not to... Yeah, they don't want the small-scale guys around.
So it's almost like the common thread here is common sense versus protecting
big business,
industrialized complex thing.
Yep. So there's this lovely bill, and actually, ironically, the poor rabbit farmers got pulled into the same thing, even though they didn't even have any federal regulation. The state health department treats rabbit farmers the exact same way. So this bill, House Bill 410, started life as a bill to help rabbit farmers, and it passed the House and is now in the Senate. And we are trying to both pass it, because it's a good bill, and then also add this provision for small-scale poultry farmers. But we've got to get a Senate hearing on it this week. If we don't get a Senate committee hearing this week, the bill dies. So we're working really hard on House Bill 410. So anybody who... you know, is interested in small-scale poultry, small-scale rabbit farming, and just having access to it. So right now, the nearest licensed facility to Lubbock is in Hillsboro, which is, what, 6 hours away?
Yes, it is.
5 hours away?
Six, yeah.
So to legally sell poultry that was raised on their farm in Lubbock, a farmer would have to haul their chickens to Hillsboro to get them processed and pay for it there, or build a $40,000 facility on their own land.
Wow.
So this bill can make a huge difference, particularly for the more remote areas of the state. I mean, right in Central Texas, we've got a processor, you know, so the Central Texas farmers are not bad off. It's the folks who are living away from where this handful of commercial processors are who are really, you know, being dealt the death blow by the current regulations.
Mm-hmm. So this is a little bit of insight of how politics works too. I'm going to have my kids have their school lesson, but listen to this show, because I'm assuming the way this thing works is basically the big poultry guys call their lobbyists. Hey, there's a little bit of ruckus going on. Why don't you go and talk to so-and-so senator and remind him that we're contributing to his campaign and that we really don't need these small-time poultry operations and rabbit operations and ungraded egg operations, because it could be an unhealthy thing. And here's a donation. I mean, is that how it works?
Yeah, so they're never so crass as to mention the donations.
Right.
But yes. And that is exactly what happened. But there's also two sides of it, and I have seen the other side of it, which is when enough constituents call, that same legislator says, you know what, this ain't worth it. I am not going to piss off this many constituents to do what this guy told me he wanted.
Right.
And that happens. And it happens with possibly fewer calls than most people would think, because we hear about it in the news, about like thousands of calls coming in on big issues like tax reform or gun rights, you know, whatever side of that you're on. You know, you hear about thousands of calls came in and the legislator still voted the opposite way that you thought he or she should have voted. And that's true on those big high profile issues, or where a legislator for some reason has sort of dug in their heels. Like they've decided this is their issue. You know, sometimes it's not a high profile one, but it's something that they just think they're an expert in. But you know, on a lot of our issues, the legislators, that's not where they are. They're not big, high profile. They aren't getting thousands of calls from both sides. They're hearing from the lobbyist. And then if they hear from 10 or 12 or 15 constituents, I've seen them go our way. It doesn't take nearly, but those phone calls, again, the auto emails, 10 auto emails wouldn't do squat.
Yeah.
10 phone calls from constituents can turn votes.
Wow.
I've seen it.
Yeah, that's good to know. Well, and these are important bills, like you said. I mean, I know so many of our patients even that would love to sell some fermented foods or just, I mean, and it gives families an option. I know a lot of moms who are working, you know, out there working, they'd like to be at home a little more with their family. And if they had a way to produce a little extra income in the kitchen, making high quality foods that there's a big demand for because our patients are demanding high quality foods. You know, that's such a way to bless a family and to help that family unit be a family unit and produce high quality foods and healthy kids. We have the sickest kids in the world. 54% of kids have a chronic disease. And it's just on so many levels would be beneficial just on that cottage food bill. Of course, I'm trying to encourage my son to sell some eggs too, so I'm definitely biased there. Get that ungraded egg bill, son. He can sell some eggs. But we'd probably have 2 or 3 minutes left. Judith, is there another bill you said besides that that last
one? There's 3 others. I'll pick one to talk about, and that's the fair taxes bill. This is House Bill 97. And it's also something we're fighting to get a Senate hearing on before it's too late. And the situation here is Texas made a decision decades ago to provide lower taxes for people who keep their space, their land in open space, undeveloped. And that's because there's all kinds of advantages for the whole community around open space land, including food security, keeping our farms going so that we can raise food for Texas. And the problem is, if you raise cattle or you do row crops, it's pretty darn easy to get ag valuation, is what it's called, the agricultural valuation or exemption. It's really easy. If you raise, 30 different kinds of vegetables for a local market, it's almost impossible to get ag valuation. And we literally, the first time this bill was run, we had the head of the Property Tax Assessors Association stand up and say the words truck farming, which is their words for these organic market farms. Truck farming isn't agriculture.
Wow.
I was like, okay, so raising hay for horses is, but raising vegetables for people isn't. So House Bill 97 simply directs the state comptroller to create a stakeholder group and create guidelines for when these small farms can qualify for agricultural valuation. Again, super common sense. This shouldn't be complicated. It shouldn't be hard, but it is. And again, that's one of those bills, House Bill 97. We've got to get a Senate hearing this week. So, you know, calling your senator, it'd be talking about House Bill 410 on the rabbits and poultry and House Bill 97 on the taxes. If you're calling your state rep, it would be the cottage foods and the ungraded eggs. And again, we have all of that on our website. And I'll be putting out another action alert either this afternoon or tomorrow morning with the absolute latest of here's who to call and here's what to say.
Okay, awesome. And people can go to farmandranchfreedom.org to sign up for that email news alerts and also just to look on what's new and get the latest tracker on these different bills that are going through. And I really would encourage everybody to do that, obviously during this busy season, legislative season, but stay in touch and in the loop with farmandranchfreedom.org all the time just to see how you can help out, because ultimately it's the health of our families and our kids that we're really, that's the reason I invited Judith to be on here, because if we can have easier access to more types of high quality foods, then my job becomes easier and people are healthy, and the food can be the medicine. So it all kind of works together, and families can have freedom to do and be what they want to be doing and being as far as producing local food. So Judith, thank you so much. That's again Judith McGeary. She's executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, farmandranchfreedom.org. Judy, any closing comments or thoughts?
Thank you so much for having me on. I think you and I might have a similar credo. We'd like to put ourselves out of work.
Exactly.
I want to get this to where I can just be a farmer and people can get good quality food and we don't have to keep fighting it. But it's going to take fighting for them for that time.
Well, thank you for fighting the fight and for organizing like this and doing all that you do. I know it takes a lot of time and effort and time away from your family, too. So thank you for all your efforts. I know it's really helping a lot of people.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, well, we'll have you back someday, Judith. Again, farmandranchfreedom.org. Y'all get on there and get involved.
All right, appreciate that, Judith. Yes, absolutely. Again, Veritas Medical, check out the website, Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Appreciate it, Dr. Edwards. We'll see you back here next Monday on the program. Have a wonderful rest of the week.